Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Just a quick note that today's episode is going to be a rerun. The next season of the Psychology Podcast will begin later this year. I haven't taken any break in 5 years of doing this podcast, so I thought it was about time to take a step back and think about how I can make this a better experience for you all. Until then, enjoy these episodes from our archives. Today we have Susan Cain on the show. Susan is a writer, public speaker, and author of the book Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Most recently, Susan launched The Quiet Revolution, an online initiative to unlock the power of introverts for the benefit of us all. Thank you, Susan, for agreeing to be on the show today.
Absolutely. It is a pleasure to be here.
I'm like so giddy to talk to you. I can't stand it.
Everybody loves Scott Barry Kaufman, and so it's so much fun for me to be here with you. I think you are collecting so many fans and admirers as you go through the world. Well deserved.
Thank you so much. I think like in my 20s, I was like deeply insecure. And the more I just embraced my oddballness, the more friends I accumulated. So I realized it's actually a good thing to just like own it.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because I find, because the subject matter that I tend to focus on has to do kind of inherently with vulnerability. I have found other people now tell me about the things that feel vulnerable for them. And people invariably tell me that the more they start opening up with others about their vulnerability, like that's when they really connect with people. Like I think of Douglas Conant, who is the CEO of Campbell Soup. And he's a very patrician-like figure. He reminds me of Jimmy Stewart in the movie It's a Wonderful Life. And but Doug is very shy and introverted, and he says that when he first started telling people about that in himself, that was when he had more influence than at any other time in his career. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that when you started talking about talking about your insecurities or feeling like an oddball, that would be when you actually unlocked all your powers.
Yeah, I really like that you told that story because I have noticed that personally that I give talks and the part where I tell my personal story tends to be like what people remember. Like people really don't remember the science, you know, but they talk to me about the personal story. It actually makes me wonder like, what's the point of doing science. I should just tell all my personal stories and retire. What's the point? I show all these like graphs and correlations, and people are like, yeah, about the story.
I totally understand that. You know, it's funny because I remember now, like, I was preparing for my TED talk, and you know, they give you 18 minutes, and it's like 18 minutes, and you shouldn't go over by even 30 seconds, although I did. But like, you know, so you feel like those minutes are so precious. And so at first, I wrote this whole thing that was all packed with like statistics and correlations and. And then I realized I had to throw 3/4 of it out the window because people want to hear stories. It's just like what you say.
So the question is, how can we make stories ring true in a generalizable way? Because that's what science is, right? I don't believe that stories are, there's some scientists, some of my colleagues really don't like stories. They think it's not genuine. But it is certainly genuine for the individual, right? I mean, it's a very live, real experience for that person that we shouldn't take away from that person. And yet some stories captivate so many people that I believe they are revealing some generalizable truths. So stories can lead us to, I think, can certainly inform the science.
Oh, God, absolutely. I mean, this is such an interesting question, actually, really, because I can understand why scientists feel that way, because the story is basically, it's like an N of one,
right.
And it's a really compelling N of one, so you could see how it could be used to bamboozle a little bit.
But, exactly, yeah.
But on the other hand, to, like, try to say that all of human experience should be distilled down to the abstractions that you get through a scientific process feels like that does not lead to truth at all. You know, and that there's a reason humans have been telling stories for all these centuries. So it's very complicated.
What do you think doesn't lead to truth at all?
I think that trying to distill everything down to the scientific process and leaving the stories out of it does not lead to truth. It's leaving out like all the blood and guts of the human experience.
I like that.
But you know, aside from the kind of scientific qualms with stories, do you feel when you tell them, let's say on stage or somewhere, that it always feels self-centered to me? It feels like I shouldn't be taking the audience's time to listen to like something that happened to me at summer camp 30 years ago, you know, and yet that's what they want to hear. But I always have trouble truly believing it.
So when I first started telling my personal story, I was very nervous. Very, very nervous. It did feel very vulnerable. And mm-hmm. I also felt as though, the arc of my story kind of starts, you know, I was in special education and then I fought, and then it kind of ends in a triumph. And I'm like, this is the most narcissistic, like people, like how are people not going to hear this story and say, Scott, you are such a narcissist. Like the whole point of the story is how you triumphed and you got a PhD from Yale, blah, blah. And that certainly wasn't the motivation of telling the story, but in my head, I was like, how can I do this in a way that how could it possibly not be perceived that way? And shockingly, not one person, like out of thousands of, you know, people I've given talks to the past year and a half has made overtly, maybe they're thinking it.
I don't think so. I've heard your story. You know what? Okay.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean though? It's like, I'm expecting it, but they didn't happen.
No, I know exactly what you mean. And I mean, it's interesting hearing it from your point of view, because I can tell you as the person who's listened to that story,
yeah,
you know, the idea of narcissism or something like that never enters the mind. And I think the reason is that I think humans are really good at reading each other's true motivations.
I agree.
And so if your true motivation is not narcissistic, but for some other purpose, I think people know it. You know, like I think we're all reading the codes without even knowing what it is we're picking up on. And it's so clear that that's not your motivation.
So interesting. Wow. So there's a kind of like a key message there of like you should, like people should have confidence to be vulnerable and know that as long as it's coming from like the right intentions, like they should like be confident about it. Maybe there's like kind of a message there, like kind of like own the truth. Like, you know, it's the truth, you know, it's, you know, can help and empower a lot of people. You should go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of true across everything. Like, I think whatever you're truly thinking and feeling,
yeah,
it's self-known one way or another. Like, there's almost nothing you can do about it. So
very cool.
Yeah, you know, if you're feeling vulnerable, I might as well say it because everyone's going to know it anyway, for example. And usually, like, whatever is making you vulnerable, probably the flip side of it is also your greatest strength. Like, this is something I really believe, right? That for most people, you know, our greatest strengths are also our greatest weakness and vice versa. Mm. So you might as well just own it.
And so you've owned being an introvert. Is this something that, like, when did you like first come out of the introvert closet? Like, how old were you? Like, when did you first realize that you were different from extroverts?
I guess it depends on what you mean by that, because I obviously didn't have a language for this until I was an adult. You know, like, and I think I first got the language for all these things when I came across a book. This is when I was a corporate lawyer, and I was probably like 30 or something at the time. And I came across a book called Do What You Are, which helps you figure out your Myers-Briggs type and then decide what career you should have based on that type. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was the first I'd ever heard of Myers-Briggs, or really of the idea of personality typology. Fascinated by it. And that was when I first really started thinking about being an introvert and what did it mean. But I mean, on some level, though, I've been thinking about this since I was 4 years old, for sure. I just remember being in camp, like in summer camp at 4 years old, and like everybody had to gather around and sing that song. if you're happy and you know, clap your hands, you know, that song. Like, I was always mystified as to how could anybody possibly think that that experience would make us happy? That feeling.
It's so funny. Yeah, I just lived in my own head, like my own imaginative, and I was just like running around in the circles with a cape on, you know, like just completely like it was story time and kids, you know, and I just didn't like see the point of social. And my parents say that, you know, like I never saw the point of like cops, like everyone's playing cops and robbers on the street or this and that. And I just never like got it. Like I never understood why that was something I'd want to do.
Right. I think that a lot of childhood is like that for a lot of kids. You know, and it expresses differently for each individual kid, right? But in childhood in particular, everything is presented as all kids should like all of these experiences. And it's funny because as adults, I think we're a lot better at knowing that there's a variety of human experience, and with children, we forget it. So, you know, with kids, we say, well, every kid would want to have, you know, their entire class over to the birthday party, and every kid wants to play cops and robbers, or every boy does, maybe people think. And it's not true.
You know, I remember a very, I can't believe I'm going to start telling you things I never told anyone. Maybe this is what you bring out of people, because people, you know, you're very genuine. I remember I overtly made a decision. I was about 24, 25. I was in England. On a master's degree, and I remember making a decision that I was going to see what it felt like to be an extrovert.
Oh.
I've never told anyone this before. I made like up to that point, I really hadn't been much more, but I was like, I wonder what it'd be like to like be like the social life of this college. I was at King's College in Cambridge for my master's degree, and that year, I became, this is 2005. I became the guy everyone went to be find out what's the party tonight. and I figured out that I could actually play that role. I was like, you know what, I can do this. It didn't feel natural whatsoever, but I was like just intellectually curious whether or not I could be that guy. And I realized I could be that guy, but I didn't really enjoy it, and it just made me like think about, like, you know, like maybe like introverts is not necessarily like you have bad social skills. I think that's a huge misconception, right? It's not even that you do, that you like talking to people. That's also a huge misconception. It's just like, it's not, it doesn't feel like that's your like nature to, it doesn't bring you the most intrinsic joy and meaning in life to be the center of the party.
Yeah. And I actually think that phrase, the center of the party, is really key, right? Because like anybody who knows you're one of the warmest, most connected people around. So it's not that you're not social, it's just you know, you didn't want to be the social director, which is very, very different. You know, so I mean the idea that all the four-year-olds singing can happen, you know, it, like I mean during most of those settings, probably 10 minutes before we were all corralled to sing that song merrily together, like I had probably been off, you know, playing one-on-one with a good friend, and that was really fun to me. So I think that's what ends up happening. I think there's a lot of different ways of expending our social energy and love, and so we should just allow people to connect in the way that works for them. But I want to ask you about this as a psychologist, about what you just said about, you know, so you try to be the life of the party for that one year.
That whole year, I was a party animal. I really was a party animal.
It didn't feel natural, and it sounds like it wasn't really.
I won't say it was completely not fun.
But wait, so here's my question. Okay. You know, there's this research that you hear about often in psychology, finding that even, you know, supposedly that even introverts are happier when they are engaging socially.
Yeah.
And I think about that research a lot because, I don't know. There's so much to say about that. I think it's sometimes true and it's sometimes not true. And there's so many nuances to what does it really mean to be social?
Yeah.
You know? And it's one thing to say, yes, human beings are happier when they have meaningful connections in their lives. And no one's going to argue with that. And it's another to say, therefore, the conclusion is we should all be gregarious and connecting for as large a portion of our waking hours as possible. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think this is, it's it's tricky territory. It's like the research showing that extroverts on average report higher well-being, right, and happiness in life.
Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for you all for the past 4 years. It's been a real labor of love. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make it a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review on iTunes. I definitely read all the reviews, and they're helpful to others who are thinking about giving the show a listen. Another thing you can do is donate something to the show. Even just the price of a cup of coffee would really help me continue to do this podcast for you all. To donate something, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com and click on the link at the bottom that says Become a Sponsor. So thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity, and I really appreciate you joining me on this journey. Okay, now back to the show.
You know, I study well-being, and I teach a course in positive psychology.
Yeah.
And I teach well-being as a very multidimensional construct.
Yes.
It's something that in which positive emotions is not even a necessary condition.
Mm-hmm.
And positive emotions being the kind of emotions that tend to be activated more in extroverts on average.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a scientifically solid finding, that on average, those who report higher levels of extroversion on a self-report scale do tend, you know, if you measure them throughout the day, like beepers randomly and stuff during the course of their day, like they will report greater, you know, positive emotions such as like joy and excitement.
Sure.
You know, they're always excited.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's true. But that's...
I know. I've never really disputed that one. That makes sense to me.
Absolutely. But what I find is really interesting is that we've sort of have this idea of happiness in American culture that the hedonic view is...
Exactly.
Is happiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I teach in my course is that there are like so many different paths to fulfillment.
Yeah.
And fulfillment is not the same thing as hedonic happiness. So, you know, you look at some great case studies. There's this famous existential philosopher who's, I forget which existential philosopher in particular, but he was like known in his lifetime to be the most like miserable, like saying like there's no meaning, there's no point, you know, all that. And on his deathbed, his last words were something like, "I've lived a good life."
Oh, that is so interesting.
And I use that example in my class.
I totally hear you.
Yeah, because a full life is a life full of a multitude of emotions and suffering and heartache and. That's actually what a full life is. You know, I do the experiment in my class about if you could have a happy machine where you were fed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, positive emotions, that would actually be, no student takes that option. They don't want it.
You mean like to be hooked up to that machine,
but
not actually
the experience. Yeah, it's called the experience machine.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking about this a lot recently and thinking how interesting it is that in American culture, like the foundational principle is that everyone's entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and not life, liberty, and the pursuit of meaning.
Yeah.
Huh, I wonder why we went in that direction. And I mean, I do get it, because we all want to be happy, of course, but it gets interpreted in a very narrow way, I often think.
Absolutely. Happiness is often equated with hedonic pleasure.
Yeah, and then I also think there's two different sets of positive emotions, you know, so there's the activated ones like jumping for joy and fizzy excitement, right? Uh-huh. And then there's the quieter ones like contentment and a sense of peace and just that feeling when you're in a state of flow and your mind is completely engaged and you're neither bored nor anxious, like but just totally engaged.
Yeah, and there is research showing...
And all of that gets sloshed up together, I think, when people talk about happiness, but they're really distinct.
It's a really good point. It's a really important point. And Luke Smiley and Colin DeYoung have published a paper recently showing that is absolutely the case that extroverts do not show these quiet. It is specifically those activated emotions. So that is
so interesting. I didn't know that.
I'll send it to you.
That's always been my working hypothesis, but I didn't know that paper was out there.
I will send it to you. And in fact, I hope to do more research on. these quiet emotions among introverts with my team of quieteers that I assembled next year at Penn, that Adam Grant gave me his A-list of A-list students and who are interested, who are fans of Susan Cain. Did I tell you this?
Well, you told me that they're the quieteers doing this research, and I'm so excited about that. So we have to talk more.
Okay. We'll talk more about that maybe off channel.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think we need hours because there's so many different avenues you guys could be pursuing.
Absolutely. Like, I have one student in particular I've had an extensive email thread with, who really wants to catalog all the different quiet emotions and stuff. And then I have other students that want to look at situational effects.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's lots of directions to go, and Adam's going to be collaborating with us on all of this. I think it'll be really exciting. Like, it's lots of questions. I think that, you know, the field could kind of move in new directions to kind of get at this. So I'm absolutely with you on these emotions. And I think a lot of these quiet emotions are still significant, substantial contributors to well-being. So that's why we really need to, and I really do look at it as like fulfillment requires a full life. Fulfillment requires, you know, a life well lived is not, most people don't consider a life well lived a life full of only hedonic pleasures. You know, you think also that, do the philosophical experiment, like the person who is just sitting on their couch 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and watching Netflix, they may be getting pleasure from Netflix, but they very rarely will any of them say that I feel like I'm living a fulfilled life. So fulfillment is taking your powers and expressing and activating them and making them come to flourish. And that, you know, doesn't require, you know, these kinds of positive emotions that that we talk about when we talk about differences between introverts and extroverts. So that's kind of my long, nuanced way of saying that I do think, you know, our society fundamentally needs to think of a broader multidimensional construct of what fulfillment means. Fulfillment really is such an individualized thing. What's fulfillment for one person really isn't fulfillment for another person, because there's individual differences, you know?
Oh yes, I really do know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So in your book, Quiet, you talk about lots of different characteristics, and you do say these are characteristics of introverts.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of these adjectives that you use: reflective, cerebral, bookish, unassuming, sensitive, thoughtful, serious, contemplative, subtle. I like subtle, by the way. Let's talk about that in a second. Introspective, inner directed, gentle, calm, modest, solitude seeking, shy, risk averse, and thick skinned. So maybe like
thin skinned, probably.
This says thick skinned for some reason, but I wonder.
Oh my gosh, is that in my book? That must be a total typo.
Oh my god, I'm sorry.
That's so funny.
I just like highlighted a typo for you. I'm sorry. Let's double check that, and if you're wrong, I'm going to edit this out. Well, let me know if you want me to edit out that last part.
It's okay. It's funny.
I'm sorry. But I look at this list. Let me tell you what I see as a scientist. You know, I say to my, you know, my immediate gut reaction is, you know, these are a lot of characteristics. The thing that ties them all together to me is that they all are all like quiet strengths. You know, they're all like, they can be strengths, they can be harnessed, and there we are more on the quiet, you know, quiet side of things. They're not as obvious as, you know, the person who's like assertiveness or narcissism. They're not as obvious, and you know, may take quite a bit to unravel the layers of the onion and see that, oh my gosh, going on the side here is some amazingly active inner life, things like that. But you know, as you know, one of the biggest criticisms would be that these things aren't all introversion per se.
Yeah,
they're quiet strength. How do you respond to that kind? Because you probably get that. You get that all the time from scientists, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have so many different responses to that. So one is, and I said this in the book, you know, my point in the book was not so much to do a scientific inquiry, but to talk about a whole constellation of traits that tend to be associated culturally. And so I think there's a reason that scientists should not be ignoring that the popular conception of what introversion is completely different from what the Big Five test would say that it is. And while I'm fascinated by the scientific process behind getting to the Big Five test, I don't think it has that much to say to us culturally. And I'm really interested in what happens to children when they're sitting at school and they're either shy or introverted, which are not necessarily the same thing, or they're you might have one kid who's quiet because they're more sensitive and another who's quiet because they're more Asperger's or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
Yes, from a scientific point of view, those things are different, but they're not actually that different when you're talking about what is actually the day-to-day lived experience in a classroom and what are businesses doing or failing to do to make the most of the talents of all of these different kinds of people who all kind of do exhibit pretty similar behaviors in terms of the way they're interpreted in our culture. So I think there's another really important nuance that completely gets lost in the Big Five focus on just categorizing and deciding which traits are correlated and which aren't, which is, if you're a person with a preference for solitude, let's say, or if you're a person who's introverted, if you're a person who's shy, if you're a person with any number of these characteristics, all of those characteristics tend to breed people who tend on average to be, let's say, better listeners. And it's not necessarily because they started out as agreeable people who are really interested in listening to others. It might simply be that their preference for being quiet has played out in the social sphere, creates people who are just more comfortable listening than talking. And because of that, they end up cultivating the skill of listening. Whereas if you are a person who really likes to talk, you end up cultivating the skill of, let's say, dominating a room. So all of these traits interact with each other. It's like there's only so many hours in the day. So imagine you have two kids who both really love to read, but one kid wants to be really social and out there with their friends, and the other kid just has a preference to stay home. Now these traits interact really differently because the more extroverted kid who likes to read is going to be doing less reading simply because they are out there doing other stuff. And the introverted kid who likes to stay home has lots of time to read. So they take their traits and they take them in completely different directions. So if you imagine somebody who is, let's say, introverted and high in openness to experience,
right,
and then somebody who's extroverted and high in openness to experience, those are going to be very different types of people. One is going to end up being, for just giving examples, representative examples, one might end up being an impresario or a conference organizer who loves to bring together people with all different ideas and preside over a great conference. And the other person is comfortable sitting in their proverbial garret alone, generating paintings. And these are completely different lives. So to just simply say that openness and experience and introversion, extroversion, completely different traits, end of story, I think is ignoring the realities of human experience. And I think that that's why, I think that's why from a cultural point of view, the Big Five doesn't make intuitive sense to people, or it just leaves too much out of the picture. Or at least that's one of many reasons. I also suspect that a lot of the scientific research around introversion and extroversion is muddied by the fact that, you could take somebody who's, let's say, just depressed, clinically depressed, and they're probably going to come out, they're going to self-test as an introvert, whether they really are one in some platonic sense or not, because their depression is making them exhibit behaviors that will end up, on a Big Five self-reporting test being an introvert. So that's just one example. So I suspect some of the underlying tests are muddied, but that actually is less interesting to me, really, than the cultural aspect, which is really what motivated my project from the beginning.
I totally get that. And I see your point. This is something I've struggled with in terms of understanding intelligence, is that you have these general correlations in the general population. They're showing what, on average, tends to be the case, looking at patterns amongst lots and lots of people. Interestingly enough, in the general population, extroversion is strongly correlated with openness to experience, not introversion. So in the general population, those who tend to be more who report that they're higher in extroversion tend to also be more likely to be the readers, believe it or not, to be the, you know, like be intellectually curious, to be interested in beauty and experiences, just it, the full range. However, I think what your point is, and it's a very valid point, I think it gets missed out on a lot, is that there's great intra-individual differences. So not just individual differences, like comparing one person to another, but within a person, we have very unique profiles and blends of these different traits that at the end of the day, it almost doesn't matter what the general population, you are who you are. You know, it's not like at the end of the day, like if you're like profile is you're like impresario kind of, you know, extroverted openness to experience blend, you know, at the end of the day, why do you care what the general trends are? You know, like this is you, you know, as a person. Why do you care what the trends are at the end of the day if, like, what you care most about is getting in touch with who you are?
Yeah. So as you know, one of the things we've done is we've started the Quiet Leadership Institute, right, where we go into companies and we're helping them harness the talents of the more introverted half of their employee population. And I can tell you, in company after company after company that I speak to, and these are like, you know, big name companies that you've heard about, they all tell me, like, well, yes, our R&D department is full of introverts. Our graphic design department is full of introverts. Our creatives, of course, are introverts. Our engineers, they say, of course, like, they use the words, of course. Our engineers, of course, are introverts. Our accountants, of course, are introverts. And so, like, those are the, it's usually the people from those departments or the companies who have heavy concentrations of people in those areas who end up reaching out to us. And there's a reason for that. And it's not explained by the Big Five methodology, but the people living in the world know it to be true. So I don't know the answer, but I know it's real.
So what, I want to make sure I understand that point really well. So what exactly is not explained by the Big Five that they're...
I mean, I guess what I'm saying, you know, you're saying, well, why would you lump these things together of, you know, the list of adjectives that you named at the beginning. I guess what, take a step back. What people are saying is in their creative departments, in their engineering departments, which those are departments of people who have to do their deep thinking work, work that's going on inside the brain, you know, work that requires a great deal of deep thinking, cerebral type of processing. In company after company, people are telling me those departments are filled with introverts.
Gotcha.
The departments are filled with people who tend to be quiet and reserved and who would test as introverts on the Big Five scale. And I think we have to pay attention to that reality and explain it. So what I'm saying is, like, I think a scientific critique would be, well, you know, there's no such thing as saying that someone who's the trait of being cerebral is correlated with introversion. But I'm telling you, on the ground, it's correlated, like in real life culture.
What would they say? They would say that you, that population are the blend of introverts with cerebral.
Yeah.
That's particular population that you've discovered is that particular blend of the genuine introvert with having also high intellectual curiosity and a voraciousness for cerebral activities.
Yeah, no, now that may be. That's what I was saying at the beginning. Like, I think we need to be looking much more at the interactions between these kinds of traits.
Yeah.
We have, you know, so right, there's a reason, like, I'm not called in by the conference organizing people to say, how can you help our people? Because those are probably the people who are the blend of, you know, extroverts and openness to experience.
Right.
Example. There's more going on than just to say, you know, you take an R&D department. It's not just they're introverts. They're high in openness to experience. There is an interaction between those two traits, and human nature is lived out in those interactions in really profound ways. And that's why it resonates with people in this way. And that's why, like, the clinical, like, process of trying to separate it all out, I think it's not satisfying.
I hear you. I mean, this is why I resonate with you.
Yeah.
I want to be clear, by the way. I'm giving you, like, stereotypical scientific criticisms. I personally never said that I don't understand why you lump these together. Like, I understand why you lump these together. Like, I think there's something very poetic about it that is getting at a deep truth in maybe an artistic way, saying that we're all like a system of these characteristics that are inseparable in how they form the core of our identity, form the core of how we experience the world. And I think there is great value to that. So I get it. Like, I understand why you're doing this. I also hear and understand the scientific criticism. You know, that's just like unearthing covariations, you know, among the general population. I do wonder the value of these covariations. I wonder the value of them for intelligence as well. I mean, I've been in your shoes making arguments about intelligence, right? I'm saying that, like, why do we equate intelligence with an IQ test score, right? You're almost saying, why are we equating introversion with just your score on this Big Five introversion test? You know, it's a broader sort of construct. It's a broader sort of label that encapsulates a lot of things. You know, I've argued
it's more complex.
Yeah.
I don't know if I say broader. I'd say it's more complicated.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I guess part of the reason I'm like going on and on about this is I actually think it would be really interesting for the next generation of personality psychology research to do much more with the interactions between these traits and these characteristics than what's been done in the past, where it's more been about trying to separate them out from each other.
No, I agree. And I did a podcast with Luke Smiley, who's a psychologist who teaches positive psychology. His last name is Smiley. That's like perfect.
Yeah. Oh, wow. They're predestined. Huh.
And it does feel that way. And I will send you that podcast, and we chat about, you know, this. And these are two scientists chatting about your theory. And, you know, you will see that a lot of personality psychologists are very open-minded, maybe more so than you realize, to really taking and listening to your perspective. You really can actually impact, you know, like science, even though you said I'm not a scientist. You're actually, I think someone like you can really have a substantial impact on the science and the kinds of questions that are asked. And you've already had a deep, profound impact on me. The questions I've been asking about introversion on our mutual friend, Adam Grant.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of scientists. So I don't underestimate the extent to which you can really change that as well.
Oh, thank you. No, I don't. And I actually would love to like start expanding that dialogue, because I think there's so much to be done from these kinds of collaborations, you know?
Absolutely agree. So I don't want to take much more of your time. We have about 5 more minutes, and I would be so remiss if we didn't talk about the Quiet Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Yay! Congratulations! You launched a revolution!
Oh my god, I never set out to launch a revolution, truly.
I know you didn't, I know. I mean, you've been put in kind of an extroverted position, haven't you? I see these videos that you do. I think it was, oh my gosh, like, if I didn't do these videos. I mean, it's amazing. What's it been like? What's experience been like for you? Almost having to act like much more social to empower and, you know, your fellow introverts and make them feel like it's okay to be them.
It's the greatest gift in the world, really. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. I mean, this kind of ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the difference between happiness and meaning. Because I'm not an extrovert, and yet I'm in a really extroverted role right now. And so that means that I do a lot of things on a day-to-day basis that don't bring me like happiness on a day-to-day level in the way that book writing brought me happiness. Like, you know, during those years when I was writing my book and like no one knew who I was. And during those years, I didn't even need a calendar. Like, I did not have a date book. I had nothing, and it didn't matter because I didn't have anything to schedule in. And I just had my family and my book, and that was what I was doing. And I was happy, really, really happy. And now I've got this crazy calendar that I can't keep track of. And so it's not like on a day-to-day level, I'm doing all these things that are actually kind of anxiety making some of the time. But you know, like the the sense of impact or just like, you know, I get these letters from people and they talk about what it means to them to feel for the first time in their lives that they have permission to be themselves. And, you know, letters from parents who tell me that like it revolutionized their relationship with their child. And it's like, they feel like it saved their child because they now understand who they are. And I'm speechless. Like I don't have words for what that means, but yeah.
It's almost like when you go and enter that level, you really can't go back. I can deeply resonate with this in the sense that, you know, there was something so beautiful about the year and a half that I devoted my life to writing this book on Gifted. And in that year and a half, it was so wonderful because I had nothing competing for my attention but that one meaningful project that I wanted to bring to the world.
Yeah,
and then you bring it to the world, and you're reminded instantly why you set out to write it. You know, to begin with, when you get these letters, right? You get people saying like, you know, my son, you know, you understand him, you know, or you know, people send you letters, it does irrevocably. I don't know if that's the right word, but it does change your life. You know, your email, I've never had so many emails in my life, and it brings so much stress. I feel like whack-a-mole. I feel like, I got it down to zero. And then like an hour later, it's like 30 more emails. You're like, no.
I know.
What'd you say?
It's a completely Sisyphean thing. You can never get the boulder up the hill completely.
No, but maybe that's just like life. It's going to move forward from here. And like, you can't go back to that beautiful year and a half when no one knew who I was, you know, like no one cared. And then, you know, and now they care. So it's kind of like you take that and you say, and you just become grateful for.
No, I mean, I feel incredibly grateful for it. But I think, I'm actually thinking about your case, and I think you seem to do a really good job of the following thing, which is I imagine a lot of just knowing you, I can imagine that two different things really motivate you. One of them would be helping people and being warm to other people, helpful and kind to them. And another would be just the pure pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. So I think the more impact your work has in the world, the easier it is to do the kind of work that helps other people. And the harder it is to have time to do the kind of work that's purely just the pleasure of acquiring knowledge. And you seem to balance that pretty well, actually. I don't know how you do that. But I do feel sometimes that those two goals or desires are, you know, they're kind of at odds with each other just because there's only so many hours in the day.
Completely. And I would also say it's partly due to pressure from publishers to put everything I say and say, what's the practical takeaway? Say, you know, I'm so excited by this because I've discovered something. Don't people care about just knowledge for the sake of knowledge?
I know.
Don't people get excited by just learning something new? I feel like, you know, we underestimate people's intelligence a lot.
I think that's true. And also just like the people's thirst for new knowledge, just the sheer pleasure of acquiring new knowledge or hearing a new idea for its own sake, for any other sake.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah. One thing that frustrates me is how every, you know, if I have an interview and I say, look what I found, they're like, oh, so what does that mean for a mother of, and I'm like, oh my gosh, can I just like be excited to tell you, share something with you? So let's end here with, you know, what is the purpose of the Choir Revolution? And you know, what message do you have for, a lot of, you know, for introverts or for anyone who wants to harness more of these quiet strengths for their own personal fulfillment?
Yeah, I mean, so the mission of the Quiet Revolution is to unlock the power of introverts for the benefit of us all. And the reason we say for the benefit of us all is that, you know, we believe just as it's great for men to have women reach their full potential, we believe it's better for everybody when you have introverts operating at their full potential and feeling happy and using their talents and feeling productive and creative. You know, so we're focused above all on children and on people in the workplace, because it's just kind of emerged over the years since my book came out that those are the two areas where our culture needs the most help. So we've started a website, quietrevolution.com, which is a kind of online community for people with a quiet consciousness and who are just interested in more information and community around these ideas. And we're in the process also of creating a video library of interviews with well-known introverts or just people who have interesting stuff to say about this. And you know you're next on my list for for being
really?
In the podcast series, of course.
Oh, wow. I'm honored.
And and then as I mentioned, we have the Quiet Leadership Institute, where we're going into companies and organizations and helping them to harness the power of the quiet half of their population. So, you know, we've been working with everybody from Procter & Gamble to NASA to the Dutch military. It's a very broad base of clients who are interested in this stuff. And it's really exciting, you know, because we have people, like, we have them take these little surveys before and after our learning experiences. And before they come in, you know, sometimes you 0% of the people answering the survey saying that they think introverts can be good leaders.
Really?
Yeah, despite all of, let's say, Adam Grant's research showing that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes. In the popular imagination, like, we often get 0% who think that's true. And then by the time we're done, you know, it's over 70%. And then they have the tools to actually start empowering the up-and-coming leaders in their organizations. And, you know, just imagine what that can do for all of us, right? If we start tapping all this potential that that until now has been passing. So it's really exciting.
That is really exciting. And, you know, it's testament, if anyone wants to see just how much you're influencing people's lives, go on Susan Cain's Facebook page, where daily you get all these commentators who are just like saying, thank you, Susan, you know. So
I think the best thing about that Facebook page,
yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but like, we have almost no trolls on that page.
Yeah.
Like, it's so kind and thoughtful, right?
It's amazing.
Yeah, like, I did one post on gay marriage, because I had changed my photograph into a rainbow on Facebook, and I had some followers who were really uncomfortable with that. And so I wrote a post just sharing my thoughts about it.
I love that post.
Blanking. Oh, thank you. Thank you. So I don't know if you read all the commentary to the post, but I was so struck by it because, you know, even the people who really were unhappy with the decision and didn't like it and it made them feel uncomfortable, like, they were all expressing their dissension in such a respectful way. And so to me, that's the thing I love about this community, however it's defined.
Susan, I just want to thank you so much for being on this podcast and having such an open-minded discussion with me about science, about, you know, all these issues, and for just being such a thoughtful, kind, sensitive soul. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, Gary. Scott Barry Kaufman, right back at you. Thank you. It's always such a joy to talk to you, and I know we could have done this for 5 more hours if only it weren't, what time is it right now? 10:32 p.m. while we're recording this podcast, but the time flies by, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next season for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.